Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome today to On Point with your host Don Allen and Mr. Ron Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how's it going today?
Fine, Mr. Allen. Another kind of cold, but not so much windy day here in the Twin Cities and in the Northland. I understand we have some guests. Why don't you kind of just indicate who we've got coming on after we give a general news brief?
Oh, well, we have the Minnesota Alliance of Black School Educators on standby. We have three of the four invited board members waiting on hold right now to join us in conversation about education. As you know, this week, Mr. Edwards, we had a lot of things going on concerning education, especially the education of children of color. So we want to get into that and ask some questions and get some answers and move right along.
Okay. All right. Let's get it moving. Right off the bat, we are in the other studio, Don. We are looking at our monitors. The governor of Arizona, Governor Brewer, who is a strict constructionist and conservative, is speaking to the nation and her state in attempting to analyze this catastrophe, this tragedy, this chaos that took place at approximately 10:01 Pacific time. We have at least one federal judge has been killed. We have five dead, including a nine-year-old child. Congresswoman Gabrielle Griffith, who actually was a centrist, Don, really a very moderate Democrat who had been in a real tough reelection. She's won her third term in the Congress. In fact, we were looking at some pictures of her talking briefly with Congressman Keith Ellison, Democrat, 5th Congressional District in Minnesota. Representative Guilford is allegedly hanging on to life. She was shot in the head point blank. We have information which we'll be talking about on the second half of our program that the actual target was Judge John Rolle, Chief Judge of the Southern District of Arizona. And we'll be talking a little bit about the suspect. There's one suspect, and the fact that there was more than one gunman involved in this carnage this morning in Tucson, Arizona. It is a very dangerous time, if you will. There's a full-scale alert. The president, by the way, has addressed this. But we have to say that this is a part of what we talked about on last week's program, preparation for chaos for 2012 by conservatives.
Exactly.
By the way, the congresswoman had been running against a Tea Party member who, in fact, had made the statement that it served no meaningful purpose for the congresswoman to serve a third term. It was a very, very bitter campaign there in the Tucson Congressional District. So we're following that closely in studio as we talk, as we said before, the very conservative Governor Brewer, who just yesterday was discussing the fact of the existence of death panels in the state of Arizona with respect to the whole issue of health care. So it is real ugly. It is real tense across the country right now, and you got a lot of members of Congress who are extremely terrified at what's happening. Okay.
Yes, I was following the reports myself after I was alerted to this, and it seems pretty interesting, and we're going to have to dig a little bit deeper because I know they're sending out an alert to all the federal types in Washington, D.C., around the country, and tell them to get extra security until this crisis is over.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, we first touched on this here on Point and broadcast in the first week in October. If folks go back and listen to our on-demand, they'll see that we actually sent them a signal that, unfortunately, there was planning going on. Tea Party was was making preparations to deal with any kind of opposition. As we said before, the betting had been that this congresswoman was going to be defeated by the Tax Party or the Tea Party challenger. She won by less than 1%. In fact, hers on election night, Don, if you remember, we were covering that, she was actually, her race in Arizona was actually the last race that was decided.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well, let's move it on then.
Okay, sounds good. I would like to welcome today three professionals in education who are joining us here on Point. We have Mr. John Salisbury, who is with the University of St. Mary's, or is it St. Mary's University, John? You can correct me on that.
It would be St. Mary's University.
Thank you. We also have Ms. Diane Thomas, who is a assistant principal at Osseo Junior High School, if that's correct, Ms. Thomas.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm here. I hear you. I just introduced you, and then we have Ms. Mary Whitney, who is going to go into some detail, who's also one of the board members for the Minnesota Alliance on Black School Educators.
Welcome to On Point.
Welcome.
Go ahead,
Mr.
Allen. Why don't you kick it off, the give and take Q&A.
Okay. Well, I'd like to start it out like this. You know, this week in the Twin Cities, well, in the Minneapolis public school systems together and education around the country, we seem to have a widening achievement gap among children of color. What would be, and I know this is a loaded question, but what would be some of the first steps that to address this? And you can go ahead. We'll start with Mr. Salisbury, who's actually the president of the Minnesota.
Go ahead. First step is that we got to build some collaboration with organizations and school systems around, especially in Minnesota. And because what the deal of it is that we are, everybody is trying to deal with this thing separately. We got to get back to the concept of united we stand, divided we fall. So my interest going forward with MAPSE is to make sure that we collaborate with any organization, any district, any group that's willing to work on resolving these type of issues, because there are a lot of programs around that could be beneficial.
All right. Ms. Thomas, your thoughts, please.
And I would like to suggest that we look at the common standards across the state of Minnesota that we would want all students to master, and then look at those standards and determine what our assessments should look like. We should look at what we want students to know, how do we know when they know it, what we would do if they already know it. So we need to look at data in regards to our common standards and assessments.
Okay, then Ms. Thomas, let me just ask you again real quick before we go to Ms. Whitney on this answer. Let me just ask you real quick here. Are the current standards not up to par? Because, I mean, we have schools, the majority, I would say over 95% of the public schools in Minneapolis did not make the yearly average progress, below average, actually. Are those standards, like, subpar? Like you said, do they need to be adjusted in comparison with other schools around the state of Minnesota and the country? I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that in each school district, they have their own curriculum, and our curriculum doesn't necessarily match with the common standards. While teachers are trying to incorporate those standards, our curriculum is not necessarily focusing on them. So we're trying to combine. We're trying to do a lot more with less time.
Okay. Ms. Whitney.
Yes.
Your thoughts.
I was thinking that for me, with the children that I've been blessed to work with, because I'm a community person, like a peer coach, and I see children coming in at all different levels. And if the school has a standard that's already set into place that all children need to meet, well, you have to take into consideration a lot of times children have been homeless. They're coming out of homes where there's a lot of violence. And many times if you have children who have been homeless and moved from home to home and school to school, everybody's not going to be on the same level or even at the same operating capacity. And I think there should be a way that it's equal for all children and you address them at their needs as well.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Edwards.
Let me go in the reverse. This is the way we do it on Point with respect when we have multiple guests. Ms. Whitney, I'm going to put on my conservative hat. I'm going to kind of take the conservative mantle from my associate, Mr. Allen. We have to be concerned about the cost of what's being talked about here. I mean, is there really a commitment to provide the necessary cost and resources in light of the inability of communities to be able to verify and certify that they've done anything meaningful with the millions of dollars that's been spent over the last 20 years?
If I'm hearing you right, are you asking me if it's really the school's responsibility to meet a child at where they're at their own capacities? Because isn't there all different kinds of pots of money that are going into these schools?
No, my question, the way that the question is crafted, I said I'm putting on my conservative hat. I'm speaking like the conservatives are talking and how the conservatives will be talking in the legislative session, which will start in a couple of days. Can you justify the need for additional expenditures and additional costs to do what is supposedly the concern out here?
I'm not asking them to spend any more money that's already being spent. I know from going to the meeting yesterday with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits that there is no extra funding for this particular school year, and I believe it's the way you work with the dollars that you already have in place.
Ms. Thomas, you're in a fairly conservative political enclave, if you will, when you talk in terms of some parts of Osseo, Anoka County, and et cetera. What is the thinking out there with respect to the question I just asked Ms. Whitney? I mean, can there be a justification that a corrective action can actually take place and things can be improved? I mean, we in the conservative community feel that we've been pouring millions and millions of dollars into these kinds of efforts and undertaking, and we're not sure that we've gotten the results for our buck. What's the thinking politically out there?
Well, in my opinion, we are looking at what we are doing and what has been effective in helping to improve the academic level of students that are not thriving. We look at the resources that we have, the materials, with the staffing, with the scheduling, and how we are using our dollars to best support the programming. And when we find that there are needs, we take that money and direct that money to that school and try to develop a collaborative effort in meeting the child's needs. Like, we have one school in our district that we have now used the extra money to have community advocates into the school to engage parents more into the school. So we have more of that nexus, more programming to help students who are not thriving in that environment. We are looking more at test data. We're looking at teachers and what techniques they are utilizing to be more effective. We also have incorporated professional learning communities where we are looking at different strategies, again, as teachers, professionally, what else do we need to do and what is the goal that we are going to try to achieve with the monies that we have? Do we need to bring in more programming? Do we need to use that money to buy more supplies? So we have been looking at that, and we are seeing some results by using the monies that we have.
Okay, I appreciate that. Mr. Salisbury, you are the president of the group known as MAPSE. Again, my conservative hat, I'm the superintendent of the board up in Pelican Rapids, okay? And let's say that I'm also the superintendent in Bemidji. I mean, putting those hats on. Why should we invest in any kind of collaborative effort, particularly given the level of racism in which there's so much discussion going on in the so-called outlying school districts about we really need to deal with this insurgency? Insurgency meaning students of color, and particularly African Americans. So what is it and why, if I'm, let's say that I'm the superintendent up in Pelican Rapids, I'm the chairman of the board in Bemidji, I mean, what is the carrot? What is the incentive for me to have any interest of sitting down with you people?
Well, it's interesting to put that carrot out there. It's an awfully long carrot. But nonetheless, I think we got to look collectively at systems that's already operating throughout the country here. I was just reading a study by Douglas Reeves of high-performance, high-poverty schools. It's called 90, 90, 90, and Beyond. Now, these are 90%, these schools that they call 90, 90, 90 are 90% children of color, 90% of those children live in poverty, but they are gaining 90% proficiency in the state standards in the state of Wisconsin. And I say we got to look at programs like this because, you know,
I'm sorry, what is the third 90? You didn't indicate. What is the third 90? You said 90,
proficiency.
90.
90% proficiency at the state standards
proficiency
of Wisconsin.
Proficiency, if you will, race, and so those are the three. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Race,
I have to ask you it again. Why is it why in Beloit, you know, Wisconsin? Why should we be concerned with that?
Well, it's not what we're concerned with. We got to be concerned with the models that are being used that are successful. You know, it's the same thing that we had those discussions here in Minneapolis right before the election about waiting for Superman and some of the programs that's going on in the city of Chicago. We got to look at all of these programs and collectively put ourselves together as a whole and say, how do we institute these programs? I mean, obviously there's not going to be a lot of more money that's going to be accessible out there.
Okay.
But what we need to do is to find out how we effectively put the curriculums in school that's going to benefit these children who are struggling. And this 90-90 program was one that just opened my eyes, and I says, wow, you know, if this thing is here, don't cost any money to implement.
Okay.
It's
Let me do this before I turn it back to Mr. Allen. Is there any contacts, is there any discussions going on with other districts at this point? Has MAPC initiated any discussions that you can share with us?
Anybody can answer that.
Actually, the question is to John as president of the MAPC.
Well, right now, you know, MAPC has been like at a stall for years.
Okay.
And I've been working with MAPC for the past 10 years or so, and you know, it seems like some of the administrators that are out there have fear about being a part of something that's pushing forward for certain demographics of kids. Nonetheless, I like to say that, you know, this is all of our problem. This is not just an African-American problem. This is a problem for all educators. You know, if you're an educator and you see a certain demographic of students in this country that's suffering, and suffering at the rate that this is happening in this type of achievement gap, if you can wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and call yourself an educator and don't have a concern about this, then you need to think twice about what your education, why you were going to school in the first place.
Let me ask you, before I turn you back to Mr. Allen, I can appreciate, John, what you're saying, but, again, we have to get through the tradition of racism. I, you know, as a conservative, I have a pretty hard time believing that it's in my community, if I were white, that it's acceptable to have black educators, black professionals tell me about proficiency or lack of proficiency in my white community. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I try my best not to look along the race lines and look at this as an educational thing. Education should be neutral.
Okay.
I understand that we have an issue with the academic achievement gap, but we got to start to looking at this thing as educators. And as educators, that means we educate all children. And that means that if there's an academic achievement gap, we're falling short somewhere, whether we're doing the curriculums right or whether our teaching strategies are right or whether our assessment system for principals as well as teachers are right.
Because we're all God's children.
We're all God's children.
Right.
We need, and as educators, we got to be single-minded to that.
Okay. Mr. Allen, turn it back to you, sir.
Oh, wait.
May I add on to that comment?
Go ahead, Ms. Thomas.
Yes, please.
Okay. In regards to the achievement gap, I think we have to be honest with ourselves that it does exist. And if we utilize strategies, teaching strategies and programming that help the students that are lagging behind, then we also will help other students as well. So it has a totality effect for all students when you can meet those needs. So it's not just about the Afro-Americans lagging behind. It will be also there's Asians and white students that are also lagging behind. So if we can meet those
Absolutely.
Needs of the Afro-Americans, we in turn will be meeting needs of the other students as well. Our focus just has been for Afro-Americans because they have a history of falling behind as indicated by data. And I do believe that teachers are the most important factor for student achievement. They have the students in their classroom. They have the different strategies that they are using. They have the knowledge, and I think all of that is very important in working with students in the classrooms. And if students, if teachers are knowledgeable, they're compassionate, and very importantly, if they have a relationship with the student so the student knows that they care, they will improve. At my school where we're at, failure is not an option. If you are not doing the work that you need to be doing in school, teachers will do what they call zap you, and you will come and work with them during your lunch hour. Now, teachers are not compensated for this, but they are very committed to all students being successful, and it's working.
Yeah. And that's the type of commitment we got to have.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Go ahead. I was done. I just wanted to second that.
I just
that's
need to add that in
reading.
There. Because all techniques and methods don't work for all schools. You may see something advertised and say, oh, that's working great over there. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work great in your school for your students. So you have to get to know your students. You have to look at the data. The data should be driving everything that you're doing. You have the curriculum. You have the state standards that you're trying to reach. But what does that data say? Where's the weakness? You have to call out the kids who are not making progress. It used to be a time that you were afraid to share who these kids are. But how are the teachers going to work with these kids if they don't know who they are? You're just teaching at the middle. So this is one effective technique that I know have worked.
Well, and just adding, that's why I say we got to have a collaborative effort in looking across the country to find these type of programs that are working. And we got to work with districts that are having struggling kids from whatever the demographics are to make sure that, you know, and I'm not advocating for the law, but the statement is very well put. We should leave no child behind in this country. And I'm not talking about the law. I'm talking purely a statement. No child in this nation should be left behind. And it becomes a moral issue when we're doing that.
Let me ask the question of all three of you, starting with Ms. Whitney and then Ms. Thomas and then you, John. How do we get around the issue of, and this was raised by former Chancellor Ree in the Washington, D.C. district, how do we begin to get around the issue of uncaring, incompetent, uncompassionate instructors/teachers, and how do we deal with the issue of tenure? Ms. Whitney, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have quite a few thoughts, but sometimes people don't care to hear some of my thoughts, but I'm going to share them anyway. And as a community educator, I'm not within the school system, as people are saying they're in the school system, but I work with many kids who are in alternative schools and most times who are already in conflict, who have already been labeled. And I want to give one prime example. I'm a mother of a son who, once we moved to Savage, they labeled my child as having attention deficit disorder, and this was in first grade. I went through many different changes and issues trying to make sure my child was continuously mainstream within the school system. And also, many of us know that children are not all treated the same, that everybody's not going to be met at the needs that they have, because if that were the case, we wouldn't have such a disparity in the education gap as we have today. And in this state, because I live in this state, I'm not in the other state. And to make a long story short, he continuously was labeled. He ended up, they wanted to put him on Ritalin. I don't believe in pills for kids. And to make a long story short, every time I turned around, they were calling me, telling me to pick up a six and seven-year-old child. I found out about the PACER Center, found my rights as a mother, and I checked into that and changed some things. But to make a long story short, my son has a choice of 200 different colleges because his IQ was 160 at 7 years old.
Absolutely.
So sometimes kids are mainstreamed into a classroom, and all teachers that are teachers within a school system are not looking at what that child's life may have been like if they're interested in what I'm teaching. And if you read the book, Kill Them Before They Grow,
okay.
That talks
right.
about a
yeah.
child is...
All right. I appreciate it, and I understand what you're saying. Ms. Thomas, but the question was the issue of tenure and seniority as it pertains to the issue of competent educators.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to share with the Phi Delta Kappa Gallup poll for 2010 saw education as a priority. And what that poll said is that the public wanted to have the best teachers and they wanted to give support to current teachers. For teachers, you have to look in yourself first, and we call that cultural competence. We have to look at your beliefs, traditions, and values and how you relate with that child because that's very important. I may respond to a student differently because I'm Afro-American as opposed to my white counterpart because of my values and my beliefs and my tradition. Afro-American kids, especially the girls, tend to be a lot louder. When they're in a group in the hallways, you know, teachers get pretty concerned about if that's going to be a fight. But we have to teach them that some of them are just very loud, and we have to give them a code switch, which means maybe you can be out loud outside, maybe in your home, but in a school setting, you want to use your inside voices. So we have to have people reflect on their own thinking of who they are because that affects their relationships with students. Are you more tolerant because that student looks like you, or are you less tolerant because you don't understand that student's culture? So that's very important for teachers to know and to look at, and administrators as well. For teachers who appear uncaring, I think a lot of times it's just a lack of understanding, and it has to do with cultural competence, how they respond culturally to students, because students want to know that you care about them, and a lot of them already feel uncomfortable in a setting where they're in the minority, and they may be feeling frustrated. They may not be achieving academically, so they tend to act out. You know, I hear kids telling me, well, this teacher don't care about me, so why should I try to learn? And so
okay.
we try to have the conversation not only with the student about their feelings and why they're feeling that way, but we also have that conversation with staff. So we're on a learning curve as an entire district to look at the cultural competence of ourselves and our responsiveness to those that we serve.
Okay,
and
let me,
I have not
just for
not
the purpose of transparency, let me indicate, in this case, Ms. Thomas is a assistant principal in the Osseo School District, which is a suburb north of Minneapolis. Thank you on that, Ms. Thomas. Mr. Salisbury, your reflections on the same question. The issue of tenure, seniority, competency, how do you deal with a teacher that really is not performing?
Well, I first and foremost, I think the federal government is headed in the right direction with the Race to the Top program. Of course, they didn't advocate $4 billion to get school districts around this country to look at the innovative educational strategies that exist, which are trying to tie teachers' evaluation to student performance. So we got to upgrade our evaluation systems, and not just for teachers. We got to upgrade our evaluation system for administrators as well.
Okay.
Now, it'll be very difficult to wipe out teacher tenure, but you know what? To evaluate how teachers continue to be tenured might be a different discussion.
Okay.
Let me pass it back to my associate, Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen, you have any questions?
Yes, I do. I've been carefully listening to Mr. Edwards and the Minnesota Alliance for black school educators. And I have to position this before I get into my next question, because first of all, we have a lot of talented African-American, black, whichever you want to call it. I prefer black because of me being a card-carrying member of the Republican Party and not a hyphenated American, but is the best thing that, the best thing that we can come up with is depending on a government program, okay? That's my first statement. Second of all, I need to go back and look at the law that started all this. Okay, he's ADD, he has behavioral problems, she might have Down syndrome. Now, public law 94-192, according to the book, which Mary did mention briefly, Kill Them Before They Grow, talked about creating of the black monsters. Mentally retarded children was excluded from the nation's public school system for a long time. It took a major lawsuit to force this nation's governing body to make educating retarded children and mandatory in public schools. Okay, in 1975, Congress passed the public law 94-142, which guarantees that any citizen of the United States 20 years old and younger has the right to receive free public education. And this is the catcher, kicker, based on his or her needs. Okay, with that said, rather than relying on a government program or a program in Wisconsin or a program in California, here in Minnesota, especially, you know, the public school district and the talented amount of African-American or black, whatever you prefer, educators, do we continually lean on a government program to educate our kids? What's the problem with us coming up with a plan and a strategy? I would like to start with you, Ms. Thomas, if possible.
I think that special education is important in school districts, and we do need that as a government plan. We do have students that must qualify for special education. Not all kids, because they act out, because they are not cooperative, qualify for special education. But those students who have the learning disabilities, for those kids who have behavior problems, emotional behavior disorders that qualify for them, that should be in existence and it should be supported by the government to help them, because they need a little more support than the regular school students. I think that we have to look very carefully of why students are behaving the way that they are. Again, a sense of belonging in the school, that they count, and that we care about them is really important. I know that building relationships one student at a time is very, very important. I've seen the change that can occur when you are patient with them and you listen to them and you get to know them and where they come from. Some of them come from some very horrific environments. They're having to take care of their younger brothers and sisters. Their parents are working 2 and 3 different jobs. So in respect to the special education, I do think that we do need it. Doctors have to diagnose them for ADHD and other behaviors. I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't comment on if the student really is ADHD, so I leave that up to the medical profession. But we should have special education to support those qualify.
Okay, before I go to Mr. Salisbury here, I just want to interject something there. I mean, I understand the necessary need to include people with special needs in, you know, educate them also. But I guess I'm kind of leaning more to the point that it's been easier for public school systems, not just in the Twin Cities or the state of Minnesota or around the United States, to point at children of color and say that you need this drug or you need that drug or this person's a problem. And what happens is, if you look at the data, you see that more blacks, Hispanics coming in, and then coming in third and fourth and fifth would be somewhere around the Asians down to the white kids. But the black and Hispanics around the country are expelled, suspended, and have 10 times more of the disciplinary type issues or penalties, I should say, against them in difference to their white counterparts. So with that added, Mr. Salisbury, what are your thoughts and opinions?
Well, that's a real loaded question, because absolutely the government should fund disabilities and kids that are for special needs and that type of thing. And if there are some misdiagnoses that's going out with our kids, and African-American kids. But nonetheless, you know, we got to look downward at the K through 4 grades and start to looking at how we are dealing with these kids, you know, what we're doing. I mean, at some point, if they get past the fourth grade and the behaviors have not changed, then we're risking them never learning anything.
Okay.
You know, so I know that the problem is somewhere back before the fourth grade. You know, if we're going to diagnose kids with ADHD, we got to look far back. We got to look farther before they get to the age where it's causing real problems. And being in the schools,
don't you think that before we're trying to diagnose children, shouldn't we be trying to educate the children?
Yeah, well, this is what I'm saying. So it's okay. An educational factor, but there's another factor with behavior in our schools that we need to look at, and that factor is safety. We have to look at safety in the schools because lots of this stuff comes from kids not feeling safe. And when you're not in a safe environment, it's very difficult to function, especially educationally. And what we need to do is to understand what's happening with these kids within a classroom. The teachers need to understand it. The administrators need to understand it. Their parents need to understand it. We all need to be on board with these kids because, you know, I've been in a lot of schools where safety just don't exist. And you see some very good students acting out in ways that, if they thought that they could be protected, that wouldn't be happening. And I've been in classrooms for the last 10 years where when kids feel safe, the whole behavior changed. So we got to structure discipline in a way where we're not throwing kids out of school, where we're not putting them in special education, where we are telling them or showing them that we love them and that we're there to educate them.
Okay,
we
got
to put up different models.
Okay,
can I add on to that? I think it's all about partnership with the parents. Schools cannot work with students in isolation. Students will come to school and do things at school that they would never do at home. Students don't know that they have to make a code switch from what they do at home and outside of school and inside of schools. And there are a number of factors that affect schools and students, and that has to do with early childhood education. I'm a strong advocate that you start early teaching kids the education part and the social skills and letting them know that you care about them. So I think it starts in early childhood education and the behavior.
Okay. Before we get to Ms. Whitney to answer that question too, I'd like to let our listeners know, domestically and internationally, you can use our toll-free number. It's 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for the Minnesota Alliance of Black School Educators or for any part of the show, please call that number. Again, one more time, 877-572-4288. And Ms. Whitney, your thoughts?
Again, hello. I will say that as a person who works as a peer coach or peer counselor, I've worked in the school, especially for one, mentoring a student without pay for 3 years following an 8-year-old student. It started out when he was 7. And his individual education plan consisted of the psychiatrist, the nurse, the principal, a case advocate, the parent, and myself. And so it got to the point where every day I was called to the school to be there to assist the child and the parent in the classroom because the boy was turning over a chair or he wanted to be on the computer when they wanted him to sit down and all these different kinds of things. Every child is at a different level when they come into the school system. And I'm not asking all teachers to be psychiatrists or to be counselors, but I'm saying we have too many children that continuously fall through the cracks and are not being serviced. And once you're labeled as a special education student, you're mimicked, you're teased, you're taunted. And at times there were kids who would say this child was doing something to them and the child wasn't. So how do we truly engage and say that? Maybe this child has gotten tired of turning over chairs or acting out in class, and now finally after 1 or 2 years of working with them specifically with their issues, they decide, now I want to be a good kid. Well,
okay,
still, the opportunity is not there to open that door for that child to be a good kid because he's been labeled a bad kid most of his school years.
Okay,
thank you for the answer.
Thank you for the answer. Mr. Edwards, any questions?
What I'd like to do, I suggest now, is that as we begin to wrap, that we asked our guest to take just a couple minutes to deal with any specific issue that we have not touched on, that you and I did not ask them, that they feel is of paramount importance for the purpose of dialogue and discussion, and that we start with Ms. Whitney, Ms. Thomas, and then finish with President Salisbury.
Okay.
I would just say, as a person who has done over 5,300 hours of community services for free within schools, outside schools, inside corrections, to hopefully try and make a difference in the disparity. We have 700,000 individuals exiting corrections each year, and two-thirds are back before 3 years are up. I know we have a lot of programs working with people, but so many people have continuously been funded for programming to change things, and nothing has changed. So that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Whitney.
Ms. Thomas?
I do believe in the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child. I believe that it takes all stakeholders, community members, businesses, and volunteers, as well as teachers who are skilled in the craft of teaching young minds and good leaders or effective leaders to help kids be successful. They depend on us. We have to push them, pull them to be successful, and that's our goal. Then we need to make sure that students understand and know that we do care and that they can be successful. So it takes all of us to do that. Volunteerism in the school is very important. Parent involvement in the school is very important and at home. And we know that some parents don't have the skills to assist their student at home, but we as a school are prepared to assist them with parenting classes, with skill classes that would help them to be able to help their child. So schools are reaching out into the community, and we just must keep that partnership very strong.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Thomas. President Salisbury, you have the last word.
Well, I like to say that it's just echoing Ms. Thomas' words that we have to be a village. And I think that that's where MAPSE stands in this battle, and that is to build a village, to build a village or a community of people. And that means all, the teachers, the students, the parents, the businesses, the administrators, and whoever wants to be on board to help us to get rid of this problem. We need to neutralize this academic achievement gap, and it's going to take all of us. So I send a word out to say, you know, let's learn to collaborate. Come and be a part of us.
All right. President Salisbury, Ms. Thomas, Ms. Whitney, we appreciate you taking away from a busy Saturday to share with us the observations, first of all, of each of you individually and of your organization. I refer to you as MAPSE, if you will, Minority Educators. We want to thank you for being on the air with us this Saturday, and maybe we're talking in terms of having you back in a couple of months. Mr. Allen.
Yeah, I'd just like to say yeah, thank you to them also. And actually, we're going to have one of the representatives on about the week before the first week in February, because they are having their Black History Month educational forum called Addressing the Achievement Gap, or that civil right, education is a civil right.
Civil right.
Yeah, and it's with the mantra of the MAPSE group. And we'll have more information about that up on the website. And the flyers and things going out here pretty shortly.
When mucus causes chest congestion, it can get in the way of your day.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Allen. Interesting dialogue again. For any questions, you missed the opportunity to talk to these educators. People always talk in terms that they want to talk to people who are educating our children. This was a golden opportunity. But the number, 800-572-4288.
Mr. Edwards, 877-572-4288.
I'm sorry. You're right. 877-572-4288. Correct.
Yes.
Okay. Well, on the education theme, this morning's edition, Minneapolis Star Tribune, talks in terms that apparently the organization known as City Inc. which is an entity that was involved in a merger with an entity called The Way, which was at the center of many things starting in the 1960s, is on the verge of closing their doors. And over the last 72 hours, we here at On Point have been attempting to contact some of the key principals, the headmaster, William English, and others.
So, Edwards, we have a call.
Oh, go right ahead. Let's get them in. That's important.
Yeah, you're live on the air, On Point. Mass is calling.
Hi there. This is Hattie Bonds.
Hey, Ms. Bonds. How are
Ms.
you
Bonds,
doing?
Oh, Ms. Bonds, how you doing? All right.
Oh, great, great. Thank you for doing all the work that you've been doing to support the black educators around the Minneapolis area. We're very excited about the rejuvenation and the spirit that we're garnering here. Because truly, I attended the National Alliance of Black School Educators Conference recently, and it was fabulous. Lots of great ideas. However, I'm not sure that we're ready for them here in the Minneapolis area because we may be on a different kind of track.
Okay.
So, I'm just wondering as we get things out there, how we can touch the lives of more of the black educators, and or if the fear is so deep, and or if the self-hatred is so ingrained that we're at this point unable to touch the heart to really believe that education is a civil right for all
okay.
children.
All right. This is something obviously that I hope that is part of their work plan or mission, that it's something they work on.
Yes. Okay.
Well, we are. We're working on it.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
Ms. Bonds, we appreciate you calling in.
We appreciate
it. Thank you.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, the President Salisbury mentioned it at the very top of the hour, Don, that he used the reference of kind of a fear. And that's disturbing. I mean, you know, particularly as it pertains to black education. I mean, we have a African-American as the superintendent of schools. We don't have any African-Americans any longer on the Minneapolis Public School Board, if you will, and we don't have a heavy presence of African-Americans in high positions in the Department of Education, though the new incoming commissioner is identified by a number of black educators as their friend and one of the girls and such things as that, though I don't know what that means as it pertains to the education of the African-American child. But the fear, and then at what we were discussing before we received the call from Ms. Bonds, which we certainly appreciate, I mean, we have this collapse of an alternative school that's, you know, been in business for, 20 years?
Yes.
And there are all kinds of questions that can't seem to be answered, yet we now know upon examination, we here at On Point, particularly through IBNN and Mr. Allen's organization and the National Research, found as an example, I mean, better than $10 million, Mr. Allen, is that correct? Went into this organization, City Inc., over the last couple of years?
Well, you're talking about we don't have the numbers from 2007 and 2008 yet, but we should have them on Monday. But you're looking at a period of 2003 to 2006, about 3, 4, 5, and 6, at a total, according to their 990s, 2007 990s, of $10,438,000. Into this organization with salaries up over $1 million.
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, and examining it, I'm trying to call it up now on the computer here, an average of $1.1 million in salaries and benefits.
Exactly.
The current exec director at about $90,000, Mr. English, the headmaster, because one of the reasons we unfortunately don't have reports for 09 and 10, The City Inc. has not filed their 990s. Is that correct?
That is correct. We cannot find them for 2009. And 2008 is out there, but we can't find 2009. And, of course, they have a little bit of time here for 2000. Well, I mean, they do have time for 2009. But I can't find anything. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking an average of $1.1 million in salaries and benefits. So What were their test scores? What were the test scores coming out of City Inc., by the way?
Well, you know, after a detailed research in that and looking on the Minneapolis Star and Tribune's website, they were not published. And we have a call here probably on this topic, Mr. Edwards.
Let's get them. Let's get them in.
Hi, you're on the point. Go ahead, please. Hello. You're live on the air. Okay, I don't guess they want to say anything.
Okay, well, we don't want to lose our train of thought, and that is that, first of all, in a period of 7-8 years ago, the organization was received a grand total of over $10 million. Average salaries during that period of time, $1.1 million, if not better. Now, in this last scenario, the Minneapolis Public Schools provided them with $987,000, and then the United Way an additional $200,000, and then there was about maybe $300,000 of truancy money, because they are involved, they being the City, Inc., are involved in a consortium of four other nonprofits involved with truancy, the issue of truancy. And this is funded through the county attorney's office, Mike Freeman's office.
Yes, it is.
Well, maybe over the coming weeks we can get someone from the county attorney's office to explain what the impact is if City Inc. closes its doors. Now, this morning's edition, Minneapolis Star Tribune, Mr. Allen, a brief article by Randy First indicating an interesting statement by Mr. By the director, S. Easter. He made the statement that the students were kind of on their own with respect to finding an educational alternative.
Yes.
Now, that's a quote. That's not anything we made up here on point. This was a quote in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune when asked by the reporter, what are they going to do with the, I guess they're down to what, 42, 43 students?
Yeah. That's really interesting that low student. I'm confused from the salary, Mr. Edwards, of over $1.1 million and 40 students.
Well, the Star Tribune on its website earlier in the week indicated that when school started in September, before their merger with the Urban League, which they're talking about, that they had over 90 students, but the latest record shows they're down to 42 or 43. And there is a corroboration in the paper this morning from a number of individuals who are not affiliated with City Inc. who indicate that they had been contacted by parents and in some cases poor students themselves. I mean, I say poor in the sense of that no one is working with them better than this, who were given telephone numbers on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday and told to call this number and call this school and call the placement center and see if you can get in someplace.
But, Mr. Evers, they don't know where the placement center is.
Right. It was in the old Broadway school, which has now been torn down. I understand that the placement center had been moved to a building called the North Star Building. But we know for a fact, Mr. Allen and I have recorded the conversation with representatives of the City, Inc., in which when the question was asked, where is the placement center, address, and et cetera, they couldn't provide it to us. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
That is correct. So if they're telling us that, what are they telling the students?
You know, it's a mind blower. I wish that I knew, because irrespective of the numbers, be it 90 or be it 40, these students are the property, or then that's not a proper word. They are the franchise, if you will, and the responsibility of the Minneapolis Special School District number one. By the way, a question was raised by On Point on Wednesday and Thursday. The district had a problem finally answering it. I understand, Mr. Allen, that you finally received electronic transmission. There was supposed to be a 30-day notice or something like that.
Well, I'm glad that you bring that up, Mr. Edwards, because, you know, it's really funny because people say that we're the agent provocateurs and doing all this other stuff.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
You know, we're just going to have to deal with facts like we always do. We are privileged enough to have a copy of the contract between the City, Inc. and the Minneapolis Public School District.
Let's talk about it. Go ahead,
yes,
Mr. Allen.
Yes. More importantly, I'm excited right now. My hands are moving everywhere. More importantly, we have the clause that says default notice and cure. And in subsection A, inability to perform.
Oops. Okay.
The contract with City Inc., the City Inc., and the Minneapolis Public Schools reads, this is the under the inability to perform, City Inc. shall make every reasonable effort to maintain staff, facilities, and equipment to deliver the educational services to be provided to districts under this agreement. City Inc. shall immediately notify the district in writing whenever it is unable to or reasonably believe it's going to be unable to provide the agreed upon quality and quantity of educational services. Okay? Now, you just talked, Mr. Edwards, you just talked about the notice stuff, okay? Subsection B, default by City Inc. Unless excused by the district default, which means that the school district could go in and say, okay, we're just going to excuse you, but, you know, they don't have P. Williams on the board anymore, so that's not going to happen, or district waiver default, which could happen, any of the following occurrences should constitute a default on the party of City Inc. One, failure to comply with any relevant legal requirement. Two, failure to perform any duties or requirements outlined in this agreement. Three, failure to respond to requests by the district for information about City Inc.'s financial status. Four, failure to create and implement an advance plan for payment of creditors. Five, failure to acquire and hold a lease for the building space used for instruction. And six, failure to pay the Internal Revenue Service and Minnesota Department of Revenue any monies due. And last but not least, seven, failure to maintain adequate records, both student records and financial records regarding the program. So, we know right now that this, Mr. Edwards, this has created a scenario because we have people dabbling in the City Inc., and I allege this so that no one can come after me, that I think five out of the seven bullet points are questionable with City Inc. at this point.
Absolutely correct. Mm-hmm.
And so, unless excused by City Inc. default or City Inc. waiver of default, failure to perform any other material provisions of this agreement shall constitute a default on the part of the district. So the district has upheld their end of the agreement, but the cure period here, it says, if the party in default fails to cure the specified circumstance as described by the notice of default within 10 days, or such other time as may be specified under the terms of agreement or in the notice of default, then this agreement may be terminated by writing, period. And it's described in another paragraph below, but we don't have to get into that. But what we're more concerned about is this falls under the legal and contractual obligations, or in this case, the inability to perform.
All right, let me then do this, Mr. Allen, with respect to that. In the article, copyrighted story, Minneapolis Star Tribune, which for our national and international listeners is the major newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, one of the at line 12, it said, earlier this week, school officials told the staff, school officials being City Inc., that they would not be paid beyond Friday. Easter said Friday that the staff would be given the opportunity to turn up for work on Monday. He said he anticipated that most staff members would. Staff members had given students telephone numbers of other schools so they could begin enrolling elsewhere, which is interesting. Some students applied at other schools this week. Asked about that, Easter said students can do what they want to do. Is that an appropriate execution of the trust placed in an institution by a tax-supported institution called Mass Public School District? They can do what they want to do. I'm not understanding that, Mr. Allen.
Well, already right there, Mr. Edwards, by that statement alone, and me not being a lawyer but understanding contractual agreements, that statement alone falls under the inability to perform and breaks number one, failure to comply with any relevant legal requirement. And one of the legal requirements falls to number two, failure to perform any duties or requirements outlined in this agreement, which made them a school but held them accountable with a curriculum for the students. And if they can't do that, I mean, there's heinous errors all over this.
Okay. Now, so we have transparency, and both our international and national audience understands the due diligence. Again, use that word, the due diligence that we perform. You had a brief interview with William English, the headmaster at the City Inc. school, the alternative school. He basically espoused the traditional party line that we're hoping this, that, so forth, and so on. One of the things that was troubling in when we talked to investigators at the National Research Institute, first of all, it's some difficulty finding out how well the board is insulated. In other words, when you start talking in terms of voiding contract commitments, operational commitments, and et cetera, you then will incur, as a member of the board, certain liability. We have not been able to find, and the district could not provide us, with any information, acknowledgement, or identification of who it is carries the liability insurance for the board of directors and what is the roster. Example, on the website of City Inc., they show a man by the name of Bork, who is, if I'm not mistaken, is the same Bork who is the community affairs director for the Greater Council of Minneapolis Churches, who in a conversation with Star Tribune and also with On Point indicated that he had not been a board member since March of 2009, yet he is carried on certain documents as the current chair of the board of directors of City Inc. I have to tell you, sir, I'm kind of confused on what's happening here, particularly in light of that this organization has enjoyed some pretty good paydays.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, you had talked about, we placed a call to Mr. Bill English, and with the technology of the iPad, I mean, if we could play it if you'd like.
Let's do that. This is the headmaster of the City Inc.'s alternative school being talked to, if I'm not mistaken, on Wednesday morning?
Yeah, I think this was, I think it was Wednesday morning.
Let's play it for our listening audience.
Here we go.
Going to call Mr. Bill English, who is the principal of the City Inc.
Alternative school.
There we go. We got a nice loud ring there. And,
Principal Bill English, that was done here a couple days ago, Mr. Edwards.
In fact, and my memory's jogging, if I'm not mistaken, that would have been Thursday morning, because that's when the article, the first article came out. The second article came out this morning. Now, again, we go back to the contract with the public school district number one.
Yes.
Proper notification of separation and the end of operations and et cetera. Is there any documentation that the officials of City Inc., particularly the education component, seeing? I assume they've been seeing this coming for quite some time. Did they take any pay cuts?
You know, I don't think they did. According to what I've been looking at, especially on the 990s, the 990s are silent, and it's like reading the Bible. You don't put anything in it or take anything away from it. What's there is there.
Okay.
And so with that said, it looks like there was no pay cuts on at least the managerial level, but we don't know how those payouts went, because I've interviewed several people that used to work at the school, and this is hearsay. I mean, this is what they say, but one gentleman said that, yeah, a teacher might make $30,000-$40,000 a year, but an administrator, female administrator in a particular office might make
$50,000. Okay.
There was some, and this is, like I said, you know, you talk to a lot of people, you decide who has credibility and who doesn't, but if you hear that more than six times in a row, you know, there has to be something to it.
Okay.
So, what we need, Mr. Edwards, I think, from City Inc. is full disclosure. A breakdown of salaries over the last 4 years or 3 years maybe would do. The contract with the Minneapolis Public Schools demands that there be some kind of paperwork exchange, some notices and things like that. We still don't have any record of that.
Yes, because I understand that just yesterday, according to reliable sources inside of the school district, that a alternative school in North Minneapolis was closed immediately as an outgrowth of failure to comply, correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Let me ask one final question before we move basically to the last 12 minutes or so. We still have a minute, because we need to deal with the breaking story and terroristic quagmire in Tucson. We are hearing here at On Point a rather disturbing story that there was an attempt by officials of an organization to approach and to propose certain kinds of arrangements with respect to the awarding of contracts with members of the school board. Are you hearing the same thing at your end?
Yes, I'm actually hearing a lot of mafioso-styled meetings with some of the new school board candidates the winners of the school board positions, and how some of the North Minneapolis poverty pimps, spokespersons are, you know, going in and telling them how it's going to be.
And that how it's going to be is what it used to be, how things and arrangements were worked out, contracts awarded, kickbacks made. I mean, are we hearing both the same thing from our independent sources, so that we're transparent and on the same page, that this was the kind of discussion? And I understand this discussion took place like in the last 9 days.
Yeah, we have to watch closely for that. As soon as I'm going to talk to a couple more people, Mr. Edwards, but I think this is something that we're just going to have to put out. If I get the okay, we're going to start seeing names and put it out there very publicly and let those people respond to their mafioso-type actions, which are, you know, they're borderlining.
They're borderlining racketeering and
the RICO Act.
Conspiracy. Yeah, you're talking about violation of the RICO Act. You know, after I began to see more of the information flow on the impending collapse of City Inc., I then had an understanding on why that kind of careless action would be taken by mafiosis in approaching school board members and talking in terms of what the arrangement would be, and that there were at least one prior school board member who was a part of that previous arrangement. And, of course, that arrangement is we come in, we tell you our involvement in the contract, and then we discuss what it is that we will provide back to you in exchange for an unquestionable vote and no examination, which appears to have to be what has happened, particularly in light of that clause, Mr. Allen, that you have shared with our domestic and international audience, in which there, at least in 5 of the 10 areas that would constitute severance of the relationship, there's already a violation.
Yeah, exactly.
Including the fact, will there actually be an educational process for young African-American alternative school pupils? Go ahead.
We have a call here.
Oh, do we? Okay.
Hello, sorry to be waiting. You're on point. Mass is calling.
Hello?
Yes, you're on point.
Oh, okay. Hey, what's happening, brothers? This is Ralph Crowder, man.
Oh, Mr. Crowder, how are you, sir? What can we do for you?
I'm doing absolutely excellent. I'm just catching up with On Point. I'm over here in the studio right now. And, man, it's getting hot out here, brothers. It sounds like it's a really I like the discussion. There's really a lot of multiple amount of issues happening in the community and, I guess, within the Minneapolis public schools here. But I just wanted to say I really appreciate your investigative journalism and the way that you're communicating the facts, and some things are indisputable, and I acknowledge what you guys are doing, and I'm on point with you. I just enjoy listening to it. So keep on doing what you're doing, and definitely all that dark stuff, some lights can ray shine on it. So I just wanted to let you guys know I'm listening.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Crowder.
All right. Interesting observation by a person who has done battle with the school district over the last number of years, has raised some serious questions. I think about 8 weeks ago we had a brief conversation amongst ourselves here on the air, Mr. Allen, that we were so disappointed in the attack, the attempt to attack and destroy Mr. Crowder, because he had raised some very valid questions with respect to the education of not only the children of the African, if you will, but of other racial groups. And he became persona non grata, and the district really went to great lengths to not only slander him, and it's too bad that some of the people that are telling us, because I understand that you kind of got a call here from a person that said, you know, we needed to be careful. Now, I got to tell you, in light of what's happened in Tucson, Arizona this morning, when I start hearing powerful semi-government officials indicate to my associates that we need to be careful about what we talk about, et cetera, I get a little concerned, don't you?
Well, I get very concerned. And you know, My response most of the time to them is a song by CeeLo that says "Forget You." Well, it doesn't say "Forget," but it says "You," and we have to look at that, because, you know, getting to the political arena here in this conversation, Mr. Edwards, we people in Minneapolis, we've been promised a lot of stuff. How can I put this? The community out there, a lot of them don't have a voice. So we put ourselves in the position to get information out there. People can tune in, listen, call in, and participate. So with that said, you know, in 2008, the community was promised 1,000 jobs. 2009, I think 2,500 jobs. 2010, they were promised another maybe 3,000 jobs by several different entities. But we haven't had an entity as heinous as Summit Academy OIC who received funding. I know at time they were battling for $200,000, then one time for $400,000, and then for more money. And now they're telling me, you know, oh, we're broke. Well, 80%+ of your funding coming in is going to administrative. Yeah, you should be broke. Okay, number one. Number two, again, getting back, we talked about this with MAPC, the Minnesota Alliance of Black Educators.
Mm-hmm.
Black Educators, yeah. I mean, if we're sitting back as a people, and when I say as a people, if you're a white boy in North Minneapolis, you're black, okay, as far as the numbers are concerned. So don't think I'm racist or prejudiced. It has nothing to do with that. I'm just stating fact. But if the best thing that we can wait and depend on is a government program, we're in deep doo-doo, basically.
Uh-huh.
Be- because nothing's going to happen. So with that said, you know, this money's going in. And 2011, like you said, last our first broadcast of 2011, last week on the first January 1st, this is the year of preparation.
Yes, it is.
So with being the year of preparation, we have to look at these items and these different things that are going on to make sure that we get prepared, because certainly the other side is definitely preparing. The Whisper campaign has already started. So with that said,
yes, yes, it has. And again, we'll just throw out the number before we go into a update on the terrorist attacks in Tucson, Arizona, which has caused a congresswoman from Arizona, Democrat, moderate, centrist, if you will, to be in a life and death situation. A federal judge, the chief judge of the Southern District, Southern Federal District of Arizona, has been gunned down. And there were more than one assailant. But if you could just run the number back out there in case anybody wants to make any questions over the last, what we have, about 13 and a half minutes, Mr.
L? 13 and a half minutes. So that number is 877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. And come on, give us a call if you feel up to it, and we can have a conversation. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
All right. Our latest update, Mr. Allen, we on this end have been working closely with the National Research Institute's personnel on the West Coast. Luckily, we have some stringers in both Tucson and Phoenix. So probably since about 11 o'clock, we've been getting feedback and et cetera. By the way, the name of the gunman, the one gunman who was apprehended, is being released by the Sheriff's Department there in Tucson, Pima County. He is a 22-year-old Caucasian, and we don't want to mispronounce his last name, but he is Jarrett Lee, last name spelled L-O-U-G-H-N-E-R, 22-year-old Caucasian. Our sources are telling us here at On Point that Jarrett had been in training at a neo-Nazi operation outside of Sandpoint, Idaho. Apparently, in the last number of days, left from there, went to Missoula, Montana, was last seen in Salt Lake City, and appeared early this morning at a Meet the Community event put on by Congresswoman Gifford. Shot her point blank in the back of the head. For political purposes, obviously, they're saying that she will recover. That's the breaking news and et cetera. I really question if, you're shot in the head with a 9mm. You're talking in terms of serious after consequences, if you will. Federal Judge John Roll, who was a Republican appointee, by the way, but had been raising some serious questions with respect to things that were going on in the federal court district of Arizona, shot dead. Some are now saying that he really was the intended target. A total of 18 people were shot. Six are dead, including a 9-year-old child.
Oh, no.
Yeah. A gunman was armed with a Glock 9mm double magazine, which is interesting, which would be consistent with respect to the training that we are being informed of by our sources that he had received in preparation. And there were multiple gunmen. Early on, the networks were trying, let's say around 12:30 to 2 o'clock Central Standard Time, the media was trying to report that Jarrett was the single gunman. Later, FBI profiler indicated that there were multiple gunmen. There were shots fired. Word is now that Jarrett was to actually have been killed, consistent with the John F. Kennedy assassination and Lee Harvey Oswald. You remember that whole scenario, what I'm saying? And so we have a situation right now where there's a full alert. In Tucson alone, the Tucson Police Department, but by the way, TV stations KVOA and KUGN in Tucson are reporting in a serious escalation and that additional threats are coming in. And there's a Hispanic congressman in Arizona who has been identified as the possible next target, if you will. Now, we say all that here on Point to say that this is a dress rehearsal for a much more serious attempt that will come later on in 2011 at the highest possible level. I think we understand what we're saying.
Yeah.
This goes back to a series of meetings the first week in October in western Nebraska. It makes all the sense in the world. I tell you, Don, it is frightening because what has happened is that the rhetoric, the denunciations, the threats against the presence of a black president and et cetera, has led to, you know, in past programs I used the reference as part of a critique about Billy Joe Bob sitting down in that basement with the Confederate flags and pictures of Adolf Hitler, and he's working on those 30-30s and them AR-15s and et cetera, and he's drinking them Bud Lights, and he's got a picture of Barack Obama on the wall with a target and et cetera. Well, I think that we're now at a point of significant danger in this country. And what happened in the shopping mall in Tucson, Arizona, is frightening. This individual was stalking very well. He apparently stood and hid in a Walgreens until the congresswoman arrived. She was talking to constituents and et cetera. He walked up behind her, opened fire. He then shot and killed at least one of her staffers. But the key was who actually shot and killed Judge Roll. And that is one of the questions that we're asking here on Point, because sources are saying that actually the federal judge was one of the prime intended targets. Now, that sends it into a significant conspiracy. Early on, some conservative bloggers, Mr. Allen, were trying to say that the gunman was either a light-skinned Negro or a Hispanic.
Yeah.
They thought he was dead. They didn't know that he had been apprehended by Pima County sheriff's deputies. So that's the latest update, if we will. 18 shot in Tucson, Arizona. Six are dead, including a 9-year-old child. Congresswoman Gabrielle Griffith is hanging on for dear life.
Yeah, Mr. Edwards, I am on Jared's YouTube channel.
You have Jared, my man. Okay,
yeah.
Because... yes, you're going to find out a whole lot more about Jared. What does Jared look like? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Well, right now it's just showing words, and the guy looks really nutty. He has an introduction from his house. Let me just go back to that.
Okay.
And there's also several Jareds. I don't want to get people mixed up or point them to.
He's Jared Lee. That's the key.
Yeah.
Jared Lee, 22 years of age, Caucasian. As I said a short time ago, he was in Sandpoint, Idaho, finalizing his mission. But the word is that he was to have been killed also when other gunmen opened fire, but for whatever reason they missed him. I don't know. It's very interesting. Of course, everyone's staying away from saying this was a conspiracy now. It's not like when we deal with the Muslims, you know what I mean?
Mm.
That as soon as something happens, it's a worldwide Islamic conspiracy. Again, he is another white gunman who just kind of acted on his own.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What do you have, Mr. Allen, in the last number of minutes we have here on Point? What do you have on Jared Lee?
Well, Jared, right now, Jared Lee, and his last name is pronounced Logner, which is L.
Logner, that's correct. That is consistent with the spelling that we just gave over the air. Yes, sir.
L-O-U. Right now, you have the mainstream media, especially the mainstream media, putting up titles or headlines like Jared Lee and Sarah Palin connection and all this other stuff and trying
Ooh.
To connect the dots. And it's really bad because these are mostly these mainstream liberal outlets that are going for sensational news titles that have nothing to do with this guy. If you look at his YouTube channel, you can see that this guy was three shades short to a tornado, for lack of a better analogy.
You're absolutely correct.
And
that's the word on him with respect to the training that he was being given at a white supremacist compound, military-style compound, outside of Sandy Point, Idaho.
Yeah, and see, and my question would be also in the time we have remaining after, I'm just letting this video play in the background because it's nothing but words and I'm reading it, and we have like 5 minutes left. But
okay,
I'm looking at this video, and it seems to me with all the concentration on national security and border and all this other stuff that they should have someone monitoring this type of stuff. Because if I'm not mistaken, the guy that blew up the in Oklahoma there, the border building there, I can't remember his name, escapes me right now, but I think he had a YouTube channel. So there are a couple of these.
Well, they had a YouTube channel for him.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Go ahead. I got you. I hear you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this guy is, I mean, you'd just be shocked. He's talking about the introduction to Jared Lochner, and Jared Lochner is a human. Let me enlarge this and put on my glasses.
Okay.
All humans, let me just stop this here so I can just, I want to just read a caption from it real quick here. It says, let me pause, okay. If I teach a mentally capable 8-year-old for 20 consecutive minutes to replace an alphabet letter with a new letter and pronunciation, then the mentally capable 8-year-old writes and pronounces the new letter and pronunciation that's replacing the alphabet letter in 20 consecutive minutes. I teach mental capable 8-year-old for 20 consecutive minutes to replace alphabetical letters with a new letter and pronunciation. Thus, the mentally capable 8-year-old writes and pronounces the new letter and pronunciation that replaces the alphabet letter in 20 consecutive minutes. So that's the kind of crap that he has on his site. And it says, also goes on to say, every human who's mentally capable is always able to treasure. Okay, I'm going to read exactly that. A human who's mentally capable is always able to be treasurer of their new currency. Okay. It wasn't me. That's what I'm reading right here. It's on his YouTube channel.
Right. And this website appears to be the website controlled by the individual that is being identified as the single non-involved in a conspiracy gunman who shot 18 people today at a mall in North Tucson, Arizona, killing a federal judge, killing a 9-year-old child, killing three other people, and seriously wounding and probably incapacitating for life a centrist Democratic congresswoman from Southern Arizona. That's interesting, isn't it?
That's very interesting. Very interesting. So,
wow. Okay. All right. Well, as we begin to wrap it, we're down to about 3.5 minutes. Mr. Allen, I think we've had a very productive program again today, particularly on the issue of education. I was happy to get the members of the MAPC group. Oh, by the way, for the purpose of transparency, we need to know that we are dues-paying members of MAPC. We forgot to do that, Mr. Allen.
Oh, yes. We pay dues to be a member of the organization. Yes.
Yes. And so that, you know, people are clear on that. I've known about the MAPC group ever since they were formed over 20 years ago by people like the late Charlie Smith and others. And at one point they were really moving as Miss Hattie Bonds, who called in, is the current member of MAPC, pointed out. They're desperately trying to get the organization back in place. By the way, one other additional thing. Two nights ago, the Minnesota Public Schools signed the contract for the new Science Academy that will be going in at City View in North Minneapolis. That contract, Mr. Allen, you had asked the National Research Institute about that. That contract was signed night before last.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And Dr. Rosalind Carroll, former school board member in St. Paul, well-respected black educator, is very much involved. I think, in fact, she's probably a board member. But the dismantling of public education in Minneapolis continues under the auspices of the current superintendent. I mean, I have to say that. I know it will ruffle some feathers, but that's really what's happening. But anyways, very lucrative contract signed night before last.
Yes. Okay. Well, we have 1 minute remaining. We'd like to thank everybody for listening to On Point with your host, co-host Don Allen, myself, and Mr. Ron Edwards. We had a great show. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Associate Alliance of Black School Educators, MAPC, for coming on board and giving us a lot of great information, and we look forward to having them again before February when their Black History Month Forum on Education will be held in North Minneapolis. We'll get you more information on that. Don't forget to tune in tomorrow if you're in Minneapolis proper. It's Channel 17 Comcast, Minneapolis Television Network, where Mr. Edwards has Black Focus at 5 p.m. And what is the topic for tomorrow, Mr. Edwards?
Mr. Allen, we're talking about some things that are happening with respect to the lack of jobs in Minnesota and particularly in Minneapolis. And so, you know, folks, you know, tune in and listen. And in conclusion, we send our deepest condolences to the victims and to the injured in the mass shootings and assassinations in Tucson, Arizona, and particularly to the family of the congresswoman. And, of course, to the family of Judge John Rowland, shot and killed by assassins early this morning. Mr. Allen, it's been a pleasure.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank everybody for listening. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much.